Palestinians welcomed the International Criminal Court's decision to investigate Israeli war crimes. The US says it objects to the move. The UN welcomes the US plan to revoke its designation of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization. Thousands of people take to the streets in Myanmar's largest city, Yangon, to denounce the recent military coup. It's good to have you with us. Our top story, the International Criminal Court rules that the court has a jurisdiction over the occupied Palestinian territories, paving the way for an investigation into Israeli war crimes. The ICC said its territorial jurisdiction in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel since 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The Palestinian Foreign Ministry hailed the decision, saying it's ready to cooperate with the court. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas described the decision as an important development, urging the court to investigate Israeli war crimes. But Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu denounced the ruling and called the court a political body. The US State Department said Washington objects to the move. Amnesty International said the court's decision marked a long overdue step towards justice for victims.
The ruling opens the way for an investigation into crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. These include allegations against Israel of war crimes, including settlement-related activities, and crimes against humanity, such as persecution, deportation, and transfer, as well as the crime of apartheid against Palestinian civilians in the West Bank.
Amnesty International said the perpetrators of war crimes and crimes against humanity have evaded justice for more than half a century. Back in 2019, ICC Chief Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda called for a full investigation into Israeli war crimes, but asked the court to rule on the territory over which it has jurisdiction. She subsequently ruled that Palestine is a state and the ICC has jurisdiction involving its cases. Late last year, the US imposed sanctions against the court. Neither Israel nor the United States are members of the ICC, and both have vowed to prevent the court's probe into the allegations of crimes committed in the occupied Palestinian territories. Ashraf Shannon is our correspondent in Gaza and joins us now. Ashraf, welcome. Gaza Strip, the besieged Gaza Strip, where you are, has been through so many Israeli wars. So many children have been killed by Israeli bombs and missiles. What's the reaction there?
Well, Wissam, the decision by the ICC is a major breakthrough for Palestinians in general, and especially in the Gaza Strip, whose people have been under Israeli occupation since 1967, has been subjected to multiple wars, especially since 2007. Thousands of people have been killed, tens of thousands have been injured, including thousands of children. This is a very important victory for justice. Palestinians have welcomed this. Palestinian Prime Minister Mohammed Shtaya welcomes it and said it's justice. This is a victory for justice, a victory for humanity. Hamas movement has also welcomed this decision by the ICC. Hamas's senior official Rafat Morra said the decision is especially important because Israel has committed a terror or war crimes against Palestinians for more than seven decades. What's really important for Palestinians, especially in Gaza, they've been also under a tight and crippling siege, Israeli siege since 2007. And the siege by itself is a war crime and crime against humanity, according to human rights organizations and according to international law. And people here believe that this decision could probably force Israel to think twice before committing further crimes against the Palestinian people. many crimes have been perpetrated. We've seen that in the Israeli war on Gaza 2008, 2012, and also in 2014, and especially during the Great March of Return since March 2018, where Israel killed hundreds of peaceful protesters, including children and women, under the watchful eye of the international community.
Okay, Ashraf, thank you very much indeed. Ashraf Shannon there, our correspondent, joining us from the besieged Gaza Strip. Now, British Prime Minister Boris Johnson has come under pressure from the opposition Labour Party to end arms sales to Saudi Arabia. Labour's shadow foreign secretary called the government's support for the war, quote, morally wrong, adding that it increasingly leaves Britain isolated on the world stage. That after US President Joe Biden announced his plan on ending all weapons sales and support for Riyadh's devastating war on Yemen. The UK has so far failed to make any such commitment, but said it is concerned by the situation in Yemen. However, the chairman of the Tory Defence Committee in the House of Commons has said that London must not only follow suit in halting arms to Saudis, but also offer to work with the US. Washington's decision could leave Britain as the key weapons supplier for Saudi Arabia after Italy ended such sales last week. The United Nations has welcomed the US plan to revoke its designation of Yemen's Ansar Allah movement as a terrorist organization. The spokesman, Stefan Dujarric, says the move will help provide relief to millions of Yemenis in need of humanitarian assistance. The US Secretary of State formally informed Congress about the decision to delist the Houthi movement. He says the decision follows a comprehensive review of the last-minute designation by the former U.S. administration. The department says the reversal is in response to Yemen's humanitarian crisis. Washington has also promised to halt its support for the Saudi and Emirati-led war on Yemen. The United Nations and humanitarian organizations had warned that the designation will push millions of Yemenis into a large-scale famine. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti is an activist and political commentator and joins us out of Sana'a. Hossein, welcome. It's good to see you. Now, Biden says he will end America's support for Saudi Arabia's war on Yemen, but at the same time, he will protect Saudi sovereignty. Why not defend Yemen's sovereignty, you know? And who are the terrorists here? And also, I want to ask you, who sold the bombs for Saudi Arabia to continue until this day, killing Yemeni children?
I think this latest announcement shows exactly what the new government or administration in Washington will do. It will continue its support towards Saudi Arabia on the war on Yemen. We remember that when this war started on the 26th of March 2015, about 6 years ago, Saudi Arabia said one of the reasons for this war is to protect Saudi Arabia from the threat that's coming from the Houthis or Ansar Allah, the Houthi. And now what Biden said, he's saying exactly the same, that we will continue to protect Saudi Arabia and to support it against ballistic missiles and drone attack from Sana'a. And this is actually one of the only means that Sana'a and Yemenis have to protect themselves and as well to defend themselves, maybe to force Saudi Arabia to stop its war. I mean, as long as Saudi Arabia will stay out of the fire they created in Yemen, this means that they will continue their war against Yemen. And Saudi, most of their airstrikes that have killed thousands of civilians and the blockade against Yemen, it's under the reason that they are protecting themselves. They are targeting a ballistic missile factory. They are targeting drones factory, as they claim in Yemen. And what Biden said, he's exactly saying the same, but he's putting it in a better and a nice sentence and nice words. Because what's actually killing Yemeni civilians, the main thing is the blockade on Yemen, which is enforced by Saudi Arabia with the help of the United States. And if the United States actually can stop this war in a matter of days, they can just order Saudi Arabia to stop its campaign against Yemen. They should not offer Saudi that they will support them to defend themselves, or as they say, their sovereignty from attack from Yemen. And on the other hand, we see that the United States is involved in the war against Yemen. They don't care about the sovereignty of Yemen. They don't care about Yemeni civilians. But this is exactly what the new administration is going to do. Biden is exactly the same as Obama, is exactly the same as previous President Trump. But at least Trump, he was clear. He was honest. He do what he said. He have implemented all his promises during the election campaign in 2016, and Biden is doing exactly as Trump, but he's moving words and changing sentence. And we have seen as well about the nuclear deal with Iran. He should actually get United States back in this deal, as he did with the environment deal and other deals that Trump has withdrawn the United States from. But he wants to do exactly to put ballistic missile inside that nuclear deal. And in Yemen, it's exactly the same. And this latest announcement, actually, it shows that the United States was involved in this war directly and indirectly, and that hundreds of thousands of civilians that they were killed with the help from the United States, and all most of the bombs that are used to kill Yemeni civilians, all the weapons that are used to kill women and children, more than 300,000 Yemeni civilians has been killed either by the blockade or by direct airstrike. They are all with the United States weapons and with British weapons. That's why those two countries actually bear the most responsibility, because the war started in Yemen with a green light from Obama administration in 2015, and the war will stop if the United States will directly order Saudi to stop it, or if they will stop all the help given to Saudi Arabia, including what they say to protect Saudi sovereignty from a ballistic missile attack. But to be honest with you, even though this, if the United States cannot stop attack against Saudi Arabia, and Muhammad Abdel Salam, the spokesman of Ansarullah the Houthi, have said this means nothing, this latest announcement, as long as the war and the strike and the blockade continue. This means that the United States actually is still in this war, because thanks to the United States, Saudi Arabia and United Arab Emirates could not conduct this type of war against Yemen.
Hossein, thank you very much indeed for your contribution. Hossein Al-Bukhaiti, the activist and political commentator, joining us out of the Yemeni capital, Sana'a. Now moving on, thousands of Mayan Marines have taken to the streets in the largest city of Yangon to denounce a military coup that ousted the country's de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. Protesters chanted slogans against what they called military dictatorship and demanded the army hand power back to the elected politicians. They also called for the release of Suu Kyi and other officials detained since Monday. The rally was the biggest street demonstration by an anti-coup campaign launched by students, teachers and workers. The coup and detentions followed escalating tensions between the government and the military over the last parliamentary election. Meanwhile, the United Nations has made its first contact with Myanmar's military since the coup, urging the junta to release the leaders. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has branded the coup as absolutely unacceptable. The United Nations Human Rights Office has called on Indian authorities and protesting farmers to exercise maximum restraint. The call came hours before the farmers were supposed to impose a nationwide road blockade on Saturday. Tens of thousands of people have camped out on the outskirts of the capital, New Delhi, for months. They are seeking a repeal of new agricultural laws, which they say will benefit large private buyers at their expense. The protests have mostly been peaceful, but a tractor rally on the 26th of January turned violent, leaving one dead and hundreds injured. Some protesters also stormed the capital's historic Red Fort. Since then, authorities have shut down the internet in parts of the national capital and have heavily barricaded roads and highways to prevent them from entering the city again. Turning elsewhere now, the US Treasury Secretary says the crisis caused by the coronavirus pandemic would have a lasting impact on African Americans unless action is taken. Janet Yellen made the remark in a virtual meeting she and Vice President Kamala Harris held with dozens of members of the National Black Chambers of Commerce. Yellen said economic crises hit people of color harder and longer. Secretary stressed that during the early days of the pandemic, African Americans were the first to lose their jobs. The recession has hit women and minorities particularly hard, with businesses owned by African Americans closing at twice the rate of their white counterparts. Community organizer Life Malcolm says African Americans have always been hit hard by the United States colonial system.
African people have always been hit hard by the colonial system of the United States of America, so it's nothing new. You know, we've never been anything other to the United States than a resource to exploit. So the fact that the colonial, y'all call it the COVID-19, the coronavirus, we call it the colonial virus. So the colonial virus has had the same impact on us as every other thing that thing that has happened to us under this colonial system. So it's no surprise. It's really not an exciting story in my view. It's just a different way of phrasing the contradiction that we all face, all the colonial subjects in the United States face.
Now, the United Nations Secretary General welcomes the formation of a new interim government in Libya.
I welcome the selection by members of the Libyan Political Dialogue Forum of a unified temporary executive authority. And I call on all members of the dialogue and the Libyan and international stakeholders to respect the results of the vote. It is essential that all foreign fighters and mercenaries move first to Tripoli and Benghazi and then leave the country according to the new schedule that was defined.
This comes after a UN-led forum voted on the interim government to run the war-torn country until general elections are held in December. Turkey, which has troops on the ground in Libya, also welcomed the formation of the interim government. The North African country plunged into chaos after the 2011 ouster of longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. Since then, the country has been ravaged by violence amid conflict between two seats of power based in the cities of Tripoli and Tobruk. A fragile ceasefire agreed in October has largely held. Elsewhere, Russia has expelled diplomats from Germany, Sweden and Poland for attending last month's protests in support of jailed opposition figure Alexei Navalny. In a statement, the foreign ministry said Moscow considers the actions of the diplomats unacceptable. Meanwhile, Sweden has reacted to the measure, calling it, quote, completely unfounded. Poland also has summoned the Russian ambassador over the decision, warning that Moscow's expulsion of a Polish diplomat would deepen the crisis in bilateral ties. In a joint virtual press conference, leaders of Germany and France have also denounced the expulsion of foreign diplomats by Moscow, with the German chancellor describing the move as unjustified.
During our meeting, we were informed of the expulsion of German, Swedish and Polish diplomats from Moscow in connection with demonstrations on Navalny. We consider this expulsion to be unjustified, and we believe this is a further step away from the rule of law noticeable in Russia right now.
With regards to the case of Navalny, I condemn very strongly, from its start to its end, what has happened. The poisoning, the terrible conditions of his return to Russia, the sanctions and the conviction, and today, the expulsion of German, Polish and Swedish diplomats, which was decided by Russia.
The move by the Kremlin comes amid heightened tensions between Russia and Europe over Navalny's alleged poisoning and his recent imprisonment. He was arrested last month after returning from Germany, where he had been receiving treatment. His arrest then triggered unauthorized street protests in a number of cities. Russia has repeatedly said that Navalny's case is an internal affair and that it won't allow any foreign interference in it. Brings an end to our bulletin for this hour. Thank you for staying tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Women, pioneers of the Islamic Revolution. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the seventh day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic Revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic Revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. Whenever the goals and ideals of the Islamic Revolution are exposed to threats, women enter the scene of struggles alongside men and prove that the Iranian woman firmly sticks to her covenant with the revolution and the ideals of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. Women have proved their potentials in various fields beside men. For the past year that coronavirus has spread all over the world, Iranian women have proven their self-sacrifice by rushing to take care and cure patients. Some of them have even delayed their marriage to help the patients. One of the outstanding scenes of selfless efforts was that Fatemeh Mukhbir, daughter of the headquarters for execution of Imam Khomeini's order, volunteered for getting coronavirus jabs. One of the honorable scenes of self-sacrifice and patience was shown by the wife of the prominent nuclear scientist, martyr Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who said that she would continue the path of her husband, although she had been alongside her husband and seen his assassination. Let us move 1 year back. Last year, the U.S. Terrorist Army, upon the direct order of the former President Donald Trump, targeted the champion of fight against terrorism, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and killed him and the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, together with eight of their companions near Baghdad Airport. The Americans thought that the move could stop the movement of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance axis, but martyr Soleimani's daughters Fatima and Zainab stood firmly and announced that they would continue their father's path. Moreover, Zainab took the responsibility of the foundation of Martyr Soleimani's school. Women have undoubtedly played a very important role in the course of the Islamic Revolution. They have shown the culmination of awareness, commitment, steadfastness, and loyalty. These women have participated in cultural, social, political, educational, and economic scenes to help advance the Islamic Revolution.
the founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, explained the role of women in the first month after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In early March 1979, he said, "You women prove that you are in the forefront. You prove that you are ahead of men. Men are inspired by you. Iran's men have been admonished by women and learned lessons from them." The historic role of men and women in defense of their religion and land is originated in the Islamic culture. Although women have been excluded from armed battle in Islam, they can take part in other aspects of struggle. As a matter of fact, the role of women behind the battlefront cannot be ignored. During the eight-year imposed war, too, women participated in various fields to support the combatants. Many of them worked as doctors and nurses, and hundreds of thousands of them were active in cities in logistics and preparations for the fronts. This took place in the era of Prophet of Islam too. Women like Nasibe and Atiye participated in many of the battles as nurses and assistants. All Muslim ladies have learned these lessons of self-sacrifice from Lady Khadija, Lady Fatima, and Lady Zainab, who spent their life to support Islamic values and ideals. Furthermore, they encouraged their men to go to the war theaters. Imam Khomeini said on these women, "This is the light of faith that you ladies are not scared of martyrdom. Our youths and our men and women are ready for martyrdom. Women are builders of human beings. That's why the domineering system has tried its utmost to deprive them of this role through myriads of stratagems. This system has tried to plunge women in sexuality and corruption through exposure of their beauties to paralyze nations." Contrary to the corrupt wishes of the domineering system led by the US, the mothers of martyrs have tried to immortalize their martyrs through keeping the love of God alive among masses. As soon as they heard the news of martyrdom of their sons, they would thank God and appeal to God to accept their sacrifice. Many of these mothers buried their sons themselves. The presence of Muslim ladies in various scenes of the Islamic Revolution has taught the women of other nations and dumbfounded the ill-wishers. A French female reporter wrote in her memoirs of the first year of the revolution, "In Iran, everyone is striving within a great socio-political development to build the structure of an Islamic government. Meanwhile, what is notable more than anything else is the steadfastness and inexhaustibility of women alongside men."
The debate.
U.S. President Joe Biden has announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led war on Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the war. In his first foreign policy speeches, President Biden said this war has to end, and to underscore the U.S.'s commitment, Washington would end all relevant arms sales to the Saudis. In reaction to the U.S. president's decision, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said that Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. The announcement also puts the spotlight on a major humanitarian crisis that the U.S. helped aggravate. The reversing of the policy also comes as a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, a major U.S. ally in the Persian Gulf region. The war, which has been accompanied by an all-out siege of the impoverished Arab country, has resulted in the world's worst humanitarian crisis.
Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies launched a devastating war on Yemen in March 2015, hoping to reinstate former President Abdurrabbu Mansour Hadi and suppress the Ansar Allah movement, who took control of the country after Hadi's resignation. The Saudi-led coalition expected to finish its job in weeks, but it has been nearly 6 years Riyadh and its allies are stuck in this quagmire. Since day one, the United States and some European countries have been supporting this war either by selling arms to the aggressors or by taking no action toward the crimes being committed against the Yemeni people. Washington also blacklisted the Ansar Allah movement and their supporters while they are defending their country against the aggression. Now the new U.S. administration apparently wants to have a different approach toward the war. In his first foreign policy speech on Thursday, U.S. President Joe Biden called for an end to the Saudi-led war on Yemen.
We're also stepping up our diplomacy to end the war in Yemen, a war which has created a humanitarian and strategic catastrophe. I've asked my Middle East team to ensure our support for the United Nations-led initiative to impose a ceasefire, open humanitarian challenge, and restore long-dormant peace talks.
Biden said he will end all American support for offensive operations in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. He added that his administration will push for a diplomatic resolution to the crisis in Yemen and will make sure humanitarian aid reaches the Yemeni people. Nonetheless, the U.S. president also pledges support for Saudi Arabia to defend its sovereignty. Biden's remarks drew reaction from Yemen's Ansar Allah movement. An Ansar Allah spokesman said the only way to restore peace in Yemen is to stop the Saudi-led war and end the blockade. A senior Ansar Allah official also noted that any action without tangible results to end the war will be futile.
I think that Biden has realized that the Saudi war on Yemen, like the Saudi war on Syria, has failed. And what might happen is that the Saudi regime, the monarchy, collapses. And that would be a disaster for the U.S. because it's one of the pillars of their domination of the Middle East. It's one of their main client states in the Middle East besides Israel.
According to the United Nations, the Saudi-led war on Yemen has caused the world's biggest humanitarian catastrophe. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis have been killed, while millions displaced since the war started in March 2015. Now that the new U.S. administration wants to show its goodwill and different policy from the previous one, the first step to end the war will be taking Ansar Allah off Washington's so-called terror list. The world has to wait and watch how serious Biden is in his pledge of ending the war on Yemen and bringing peace to the impoverished Arab country.
Joining us on this debate, we have author of No More War, Mr. Daniel Kovala, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also from New York, we have author and activist Sarah Flounders. Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Kovala in Pittsburgh. U.S. President Joe Biden announced an end to U.S. support for the Saudi-led military offensive in Yemen, indicating that the new administration is planning a more active role in efforts to end the country's war. Will he act on those comments? For example, will he actually sign the bill, the same bipartisan bill that the Senate tried to get past Donald Trump?
Well, all that remains to be seen. First of all, obviously, those of us who care about peace, who care about human rights, welcome Biden's statement that he's going to end support of Saudi Arabia's offensive operations in Yemen. We've been pushing the U.S. to end its support for the Saudi war for some time. At the same time, the fact that he uses words like offensive operations while saying that he's going to still help Saudi Arabia with its defense and still helped Saudi Arabia allegedly go after al-Qaeda in Yemen, when in fact Saudi Arabia has been partnering with al-Qaeda in Yemen, makes me wonder what the policy really is. I just think we don't know. Right now, he's, you know, put loopholes in big enough for a Mack truck to drive through. So I think the situation has to be monitored very, very seriously.
Sarah Flounders, the U.S. president said in a speech at the State Department that the war has to end, and to underscore our commitment, we're ending all American support for offensive operations in the war in Yemen, including relevant arms sales. Is that enough, though? Ending offensive support. Isn't it about time, in your opinion, for maybe a less hawkish U.S. foreign policy, one with less bombs and more aid and actual diplomacy?
Certainly. This is absolutely true, because it's semantics to say, well, we're going to end some offensive aid, and yet we're going to keep defending Saudi Arabia, really means that there's a back door in this that you could drive a truck through. If there's any sincerity, the first step is to absolutely end the U.S. Foreign terrorist organization label that they've put on the Ansarullah movement, on the Houthi movement, to immediately end the siege, to end the sanctions, to allow immediate aid to arrive in Yemen. Those are the first steps. And just a general statement that the U.S. will now set up a negotiation, we saw where that led in Syria. They've supposedly been negotiating while being actively involved now for many years, and the sanctions have continued and the efforts to stop rebuilding. So what does it mean in Yemen? I think we should use it as an opportunity to really demand that there be real life to this. What the U.S. has found is that they were unable, despite years of bombing, and this was really a U.S. war. It was never Saudi Arabia alone. It couldn't have lasted one day without U.S. technicians, U.S. aircraft, U.S. bombs, equipment, satellite reconnaissance, U.S. Navy blockade. All of this was a U.S. war. Will it really end? That's the question. And will Yemen have a chance to breathe a sigh of relief? Clearly, it didn't succeed. And a people's movement in Yemen has been able to survive and continue a resistance. And we should really salute that struggle and that determination, that resistance, because it shows that it's possible, even against massive bombardment of school buses and schools and hospitals and marketplaces and wedding parties. We should just think of the crimes of the past years.
Daniel Kovalik, that's an interesting point. Our guest in New York just brought up, if Biden is serious, here's a first step. Reverse the designation of Ansarullah as a terrorist organization. The UN and aid groups have called the designation to be reversed numerous times, warning that it would push Yemen into a large-scale famine and it would seriously impede humanitarian activities in Yemen. Do you think he'll reverse it?
Well, first of all, I agree that that has to be done immediately. I'm concerned that he has not done it yet. That would not take anything but for the State Department to reverse that. It can be done by fiat. You know, we don't need people to vote on it. Why hasn't he done it yet? So I don't know if he's going to do it, but I agree it has to be done, because once you declare – they've essentially declared the government of Yemen a terrorist organization. And what that means, under binding Security Council resolutions, countries cannot trade with Yemen. They cannot do banking with Yemen. And so, as you know, the UN has raised the alarm that that designation will only deepen the worst humanitarian crisis the world has known since World War II.
Sarah Flounders, reacting to the news of the U.S. president's comments, Yemen's Supreme Political Council said the Yemenis will not be fooled by mere U.S. statements. In other words, they want to see action. Why should they trust Washington? In fact, back in 2015, it was the Obama administration, along with Vice President Joe Biden, that gave Riyadh the support to carry out this war in the first place, as you mentioned also.
Well, it is heartening, their statement, that they will not be fooled, because it means that they really understand deeply from the beginning this was a U.S. war. They know who they're up against. They have clear demands for how to end the siege and how to have legitimate negotiations, if that's what's on called for. But they also see through the Biden administration. There is a new cabinet, but they all, every single one of the people that Biden has named, are really war criminals in their threats against Iran for many years, and their war in Afghanistan and in Iraq and in Syria and in Libya and Yemen. So we shouldn't give any credence to Biden or Blinken in terms of the State Department. I think we need to continue real support for a people's movement and struggle in Yemen, and also show confidence they know who they're dealing with. So I thought that the response today, from the Supreme Military Council and from senior officials shows that they, as a political force, know who they're dealing with and are preparing next steps ahead. So it's a difficult time, because this will be used internationally. Biden is trying to position himself in a new way to continue war in the region.
Daniel Kovalik, should the Yemenis trust the United States?
No, of course not. I mean, the U.S. has, look at Vietnam was a famous case where, of course, at every moment we were about to win and pull out of Vietnam, when in fact it went on for many years. Same thing in Afghanistan, right? We're now 20 years into that war. Trump was actually trying to withdraw troops. It's clear that now Biden is going to stop that withdrawal. The U.S. cannot be trusted on this. I will say, though, that, one thing that gives me pause is whether, in fact, Biden does want to end some of the conflicts in the Middle East, because he has his sights on bigger game. For example, the very influential Atlantic Council just released a white paper urging Biden to engage in regime change in China. China clearly being a target of the Biden administration, and possibly Russia. So I agree with my colleague that, whatever the result for Yemen, and obviously we want to see peace in Yemen, I think we have to be vigilant to see what Biden is going to do also in the rest of the world.
Ms. Founders, here's another perspective. Skeptics are saying that Biden is basically just sweet-talking right now, that he's an old wolf of U.S. foreign policy, and he isn't going to let down the U.S.-backed dictatorships in the Middle East that they've armed and supported for so long. Do you see it in that light as well?
I very much do. He is an old wolf, an old war criminal. Let's really say who he is. The staunchest supporter of the U.S. war in Iraq, in Syria, in Afghanistan, and Yemen. And even Blinken in the confirmation hearing said, well, we have to relook at sanctions so they give the greatest pain. Those are his words. A conscious understanding. These are really criminal forces within U.S. policy. But I do so much agree with Dan. They are trying to reposition themselves on how they can really focus attention on China, on Russia, on Iran. And so can they reposition themselves with forces here in the U.S. to disarm the movement here? Can they reposition themselves with European forces, EU, and some of the NATO forces? Can they put a new look on their wars? That's what they're attempting to do. And at the same time, they are going full steam ahead to make new threats on the world. It's a very dangerous time, because clearly the U.S. Economic position is weakening, and their ability to impose their will on the world has been severely challenged. But again, we should really applaud the struggle in Yemen for surviving these difficult years, and as a cohesive force, with an understanding of what they're up against.
Daniel Kovalik, let's get your thoughts on the matter as well. Do you think that Joe Biden, he's not one to let the likes of the Saudis down, is he?
No, of course not, and he's made that clear. He made it clear publicly, and he also talked to the Saudis before making this announcement, making it clear that the announcement was not going to affect U.S.-Saudi relationships. So clearly, Biden will continue his relationship with Saudi Arabia, continue, it looks like, Trump's policies towards Israel. We just saw that the Senate, for example, unanimously approved to continue the U.S.'s embassy to Israel in Jerusalem, for example. I think he will continue those policies. I think what you're going to see is, you know, at least on its face, a kinder, gentler leader of imperialism. But that does not mean it's any less aggressive or cruel. In fact, Intercept recently reminded us that the CIA, in an internal document, thought Obama was the best leader for the United States because, you know, the world and Americans interested in peace trusted him. And so he was able to get away with things, including the war in Libya, that other presidents could not. And I think Biden will do the same. I mean, the irony of Trump is that while he was coarse and he was poorly spoken and he was openly racist, which are all bad things, he showed the true face of American imperialism. And that was actually a good thing. And I think the world woke up a bit, and Biden is hoping the world's going to go back to sleep.
Sarah Flounders, the reversing of this policy, it definitely is a rebuke to Saudi Arabia, which has been a long time a U.S. Strategic ally. If Biden's position or the U.S.'s position isn't going to change too much with regards to Riyadh, then what kind of message is this sending to the Saudis?
Well, it's really sending them a message that there's going to be some new positioning, but there's no pullback in military assistance or in diplomatic political support. So the message is, you know, we're changing the game a bit. Don't worry too much. The U.S. well knows how to drag negotiations on for years and make demand after demand on the forces that they're negotiating with. Clearly, they want to demand and try to divide the movement in Yemen. That's their first goal in opening negotiations, who they speak to, who they're speaking to on one ear and then the other. They, of course, want to weaken and undermine the position of Iran in the region. And so there's a lot that Saudi Arabia is a real pillar, absolutely, of U.S. Domination and control in the region, but it is a pillar, you know, based on sand. It's a completely corrupt regime held in the hands of one family with seething discontent below. So, you know, they may be looking for ways even to shore up and get Saudi Arabia out of a very difficult position by more actively engaging in negotiations and not just sitting next to them at the bomb control missions, which is what they've been doing, not just servicing the planes militarily, but intervening more politically with the regime. So, but that's not an effort of liberation at all. It's not an effort at human rights for anyone in the region ever.
Daniel, let's hit rewind here for a second. On the campaign trail for the presidency, Joe Biden said that he would punish Saudi leaders for Jamal Khashoggi's murder, adding that he believed the order was given by the Crown Prince, Mohammed bin Salman. He said, and I quote, "We will in fact make them the pariah that they are, and they have to be held accountable for murdering children in Yemen." I'd like to get your thoughts on those comments made by Joe Biden. Should Riyadh start to worry a little bit if Biden is to keep his election campaign promises?
First of all, I would agree that Riyadh should be punished for these things, particularly the war in Yemen, which is, in my belief, a genocidal war, which has already destroyed hundreds of thousands of lives, destroyed you know, countless UNESCO historic sites. But I don't believe that Biden will do that. I think it's clear he won't. I think if he was going to do that, he would have signaled it. I think that is clearly a promise he is going to back off of.
And Ms. Flounders, your thoughts on that issue as well. We've got probably less than 30 seconds to get your final thoughts.
Yeah, I very much agree. Biden said a lot of things during his campaign, and so far he's falling short on every single one of them. You know, politicians make campaign promises, and then there's a reality of the institution that they represent, which is U.S. imperialism. They want to continue that domination, and at great cost to the people of the world and the people right here at home. So I wouldn't trust one
promise. All right, thanks a lot. Allow me to thank my guests. Author of No More War, Daniel Cavallo, joining us from Pittsburgh. Also, thanks to author and activist Sarah Flounder speaking to us from New York. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on this debate. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily, round the clock, for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz every day from 1520 to 1620 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 MHz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You're listening to the program The Key on IRIB English Radio with Shiraz Hossein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom and a PhD in philosophy.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB English Radio. I'm your host, Shiraz Agha. Thank you for joining us here today. Today we're going to be examining a very important problem, and that is the problem of God's sole right to legislate. We know that God Almighty is the creator of the universe, and therefore He is the owner of all beings. When we say owner, meaning cosmologically He's the owner. He owns their very existence, and therefore He is the only being who who regulates them, and he has authority over them, and consequently he has the right to govern them. And therefore, based on this right to rule, and based on this authority and this right to regulate and manage them, he has the right to legislate and formulate laws for them. A question arises is that we see today in Islamic governments, such as the various Islamic governments that we see in the world today, we see that these governments, they form cabinets, they form congresses, senates, or whatever, or to put it in other words, they're divided into various branches: the executive branch, the legislative branch. They're divided into various branches, one of which is the legislative branch of the government, right? Whose responsibility is the formulation of laws. Doesn't this contradict what we just mentioned, that God has the sole right to legislate? The answer to this question is no. And this doesn't contradict this. And if governments, Islamic governments, if one part of an Islamic government is a legislative division of this government, it doesn't detract from the Islamic legitimacy of this government. Why? Because this branch of government doesn't have any responsibility but the responsibility of the demarcation and the delineation of certain boundaries and limits, which is manifested in the form of a program, which they then give to the authorities under them in the government, within the parameters of which the divine laws should be applied. This is all that these people do. It sounds complicated, but it's really quite simple. God Almighty has given us certain laws, right? Which He has explained to us in the Quran and in the Sunnah of the Prophets and the Imams, alayhi salam. We have these laws in our hand. The question arises, how do we implement them within society? This legislative branch of government, right? Its responsibility is to set out and to write out a program and to set out certain parameters within which these laws are to be applied. They then, after writing this out, which comes in the form of, like, let's say, a constitution or a charter, which then they hand over to the people under them, the authorities under them, who then apply these laws to society. In the Holy Quran, we see that in many verses, God Almighty says that any law which is not in accordance with the divine law will be considered disbelief and oppression and transgression. For example, in Surah Maidah, verse 44, God says, "وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْكَافِرُونَ." Somebody legislates by means, or somebody rules by means of a law that God has not revealed, then this person is a disbeliever. وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الظَّالِمُونَ. If somebody does not rule by means of a law that God has revealed, this person is an oppressor. This is mentioned in Surah Maidah, verse 45. Also, God says, وَمَنْ لَمْ يَحْكُمْ بِمَا أَنزَلَ اللَّهُ فَأُولَٰئِكَ هُمُ الْفَاسِقُونَ. If somebody does not rule based on the law that God has revealed, this person is a transgressor. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at God's right to legislate and its relationship with the human governance. Until next time, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
That was Shiraz Hussein Agha, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Rome and a PhD in philosophy, on the program The Key on IRIB English Radio.
You can also send your questions to English Radio at irib.ir.